The BioRevolution Podcast.
Your hosts,
Luise von Stechow
and Andreas Horchler. This time, more boom or bust, maybe, what to expect from AI in biotech in 2025. The advent of DeepSeek, that for many appears to be better than other AI chatbots, at least letting the stock market go crazy. 2025, in a way, if we look at technology, starts with quite a timpani roll. But what do we expect for biology, for pharma, for medicine? Welcome to the BioRevolution podcast. Welcome, Easy. Guess we start with our title announcement because we have a change.
Yeah, we have a change. We're dropping the We're Doomed, We're Saved, although we still stand by the content that we're creating. So we're really still thinking about which of the technologies are really the towards the benefit of humankind and which ones are more towards the potential doom. That said, the title is quite a mouthful, we realized, and what we're really talking about is the BioRevolution. So we'll stick with the BioRevolution podcast.
Okay, that's what we'll do from now on. And things don't change that much. And to prove that, you brought quotes.
I did bring quotes, and I brought quite a few of them, and I'm not able to decide, so I'll read them all.
Okay.
So the first one is from Peter Lyons. He's the vice chair of Deloitte, a big consulting firm. And he says, we are moving from the experimentation and hype stage to the how am I using it to improve my business stage. That shift happened over the course of this year, and I think we'll see even more of it in the next year. So this is really about AI becoming less of a tool to talk about and more of a tool to actually use in business. And this is related also to pharma and biotech. The other one is from like really an industry veteran, I would say, George Yancopoulos. He's the CSO of Regeneron, and I think he's been the CSO of Regeneron for a very long time. I think almost 40 years, I'm not sure.
Regeneron? What's the company?
Regeneron is the targeted biology founding company, I would say. So they were like really amongst the first or the first who came up with these ideas of targeted drugs, especially for cancer. And he's the CSO and I think also brain behind the operation, I would say. And he's a little bit skeptical of AI. And in a recent article with Endpoint News, he gave two quotes that I liked. So he said, and he compared AI to the stem cell boom that we had like a couple of decades, somewhat 30 years ago, where I don't know if you remember that, but there massive hopes, billions of investment. Yeah. And we know today stem cells still seem relevant, but the payoffs for human health have not been as high as we might have thought. And what he's saying is there's no miracles coming from stem cells and AI. Another quote that he gave, and I also like that because he says like machine learning is a very useful tool, but there is no intelligence in artificial intelligence. He says understanding patterns is what it works for. Most of the other hype about how great it's going to be is pretty unlikely to deliver, which is nice.
But let alone the time we spent in knowing patterns and deciphering patterns that makes sense. And that brings us to chapter one, if you will.
May I read one more quote?
Of course.
Actually,
go ahead.
Very funny, which
sure.
I came across today, which also comes from an Endpoints article from Demis Hassabis, DeepMind founder who was awarded the Nobel Prize for AlphaFold last year. And we'll talk a little bit about the trend of data generation in biotech, which is actually a huge one. And he kind of bashes this trend in the quote a little bit. He said, I won't name names of other AI biotechs. You know them very well. But I feel like they always talk about, we just need more data. We don't have enough data, Hassabis says. It feels like a bit of a crutch, like make your algorithms better, your models better. You do have enough data if you were innovative enough on your algorithm side. I found that a little bit funny, quite provocative, I have
Absolutely.
To say. I won't name names.
Yeah.
So this is really like going against this trend of data generation that we're going to get into in a second. So yeah. I think this captures the whole scale.
By the way, a number of years back, I talked to an AI prof and he was a math guy, you know, so not in biology or so, but real the bare truth in mathematics. And He even then was referring to getting rid or figuring out how AI can live with fewer data. And I'm very curious where that will lead us in our podcast. But first off, lay of the land, artificial intelligence and drug development. The question always is, and not only for business cases, but for patients, of course, at the end of the day, are there true benefits or is it a bursting bubble?
Yeah, and I think we're unfortunately not really closer to answer this question.
Still not.
We have seen really big milestones in 24. I would name, for example, the awarding of the Nobel Prize to, on the one hand, the DeepMind team, Hassabis and John Jumper, but on the other hand, also David Baker at the University of Washington in Seattle. May I add as a side note, he was the partner, the husband of my supervisor when I was there for an internship.
Wow. Amazing.
Just saw him twice. Yeah, fun side note. There's also the biggest biotech founding in the AI sector with $1 billion in founding. That's Zyra. They actually use the technology from David Baker's lab for protein production or protein design, moving towards antibody production. So this, again, I would say is a big milestone. But that said, I mean, these are, can we call it intangible values? So, I mean, investment in biotech is a bet. We see that with now the stock market responding to DeepSeek.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yesterday. We're recording on the 28th of January for anyone listening, 25, where we have seen that there is some volatility when it comes to large language models in at least the NASDAQ. So these are big events, but the question is how much do they mean? On the other hand, we have some hard evidence of clinical efficacy for some AI-developed drugs, but I would not go as far as to call that a proof of concept for the technology. I think what we would maybe call the closest to a proof of concept is the TNIC inhibitor from InSilico that got positive phase 2 data in IPF. It's a lung disease where the lung starts scarring, and there at least you could show that a drug that was developed in a relatively short timeline with the help of AI then could show real improvements in clinical endpoints. We don't see that so far very often, and we have not a single AI-approved drugs, even though the technology, let's say in its current state, what we would call AI-based biotech drug development, I would say, can say maybe 10 years around. So, and just saw like in a McKinsey report up till 23, around $50 billion of investment. I think these, I mean, we don't really know how much investment there really is because we need to decide what is AI and what isn't. But let's stick with that. That's a big number. But we don't really know, is this investment paying off?
But I mean, one side question would be, could it at all? Because adulthood of AI happened, what, 2 years ago? So it's only natural that we don't have that many proof of concepts yet.
Absolutely. And I think, in my opinion, it will pay off. And it will pay off big time, but there is also a chance that it won't. And I would not discount that chance. I still think that there are many use cases where I can really make a big contribution. It's just the question if what we're betting on now is really going to be it.
And while we're doing that, there's simultaneously the grasping for the higher hanging fruit, the new applications that come or might come with AI. So this is all happening at the same time, right?
Yeah, I think this is exactly it. So on the one hand, we have the, I would call them lower hanging fruits. And we talked about AI in biotech and drug development before, thinking about this more automation tasks versus the creativity tasks. And I would say even for the automation tasks, even for this lower hanging fruit of saving time and money, we don't really have a proof of concept yet because we lack the benchmark. We know anecdotally that, of course, the biotechs who develop their drugs with the help of AI say they are faster. I believe that some of them really are faster. Otherwise, it would be a waste of investment. But how much faster are they on average? Are they really bringing molecules into the clinic, targeting targets that will be, in the long run, be more successful? This we simply don't know yet. And I have to say that the targets that these drugs are targeting, so what we're really biologically addressing, is currently not that different from drug targets that are discovered without AI, which makes complete sense. And I think we talked about that before. It's not so good to change too many factors in a system if you want to show that it works. So if you do everything new, the chance to fail in an industry that has a success rate of about 10% will be even higher. So obviously, it makes sense to go for this lower hanging fruit, but still we really lack the confidence to say that it even works there. At the same time, we're grasping for the higher hanging fruit, which I would say are more clinical applications, which is biology driven applications that are not only discovering molecules, discovering targets, but really understanding human biology. This is a massively high-hanging fruit. It's the golden apple at the top of the tree for me. I'm a biologist. Mm-hmm. I don't care for chemistry so much. But it's really like, if we understand human biology, we could design completely targeted drugs that not only treat disease, but might even prevent it. This would be amazing. And then we also have, and this I would say is maybe a middle high-hanging fruit, more innovative molecules. Because in the past, this first group of AI biotechs, they were quite exclusively targeted towards chemical molecules. There are some exceptions, but initially it was mostly chemistry, some nucleotides, DNA and RNA. And now we're seeing more protein production. We're seeing antibodies, for example, with Zaira or Nabla. We're seeing a number of companies designing proteins that don't exist in nature. We talked about that in the past, and we just got some recent news on that from OpenAI. This is very exciting stuff that's happening, and with different methods from different companies. So I think this is pretty cool. There are groups of proteins that are quite interesting to design. And I have three examples where very recently companies or labs have designed de novo new proteins that don't exist in nature, but that could be quite useful. One is the most recent, that is from OpenAI, that together with Retro Biosciences, it's a startup, they are tackling cell rejuvenation. We had an episode on that, so trying to make young or old cells young again. And there's a group of factors, the so-called Yamanaka factors, they were found in 2006 while I was studying. Everyone was super excited, where for the first time you could turn adult cells, mainly skin cells, back in pluripotent, in stem cells that have the capacity to turn into any type of cell of the body. These factors have a relatively low efficiency if you use them, I think around 1%. So what OpenAI did together with a partner is to develop a version of ChatGPT, GPT-4B micro model, that can design proteins. And they designed versions of these Yamanaka factors that are 50 times more efficient. So this is pretty cool. That said, I mean, as we had the quote in the beginning, I don't think that the efficiency of reprogramming is the current problem of stem cell as a medical application. I think there is some other things that we need to solve in terms of delivery, in terms of really understanding what happens if you rejuvenate either outside or inside the body. But it's still a pretty cool use case. And as far as I understood it, I think it's not completely solid, but I think they're also going to raise around $1 billion, also with the help of Sam Altman. And some of the headlines were that also Sam Altman doesn't want to get old, because I mean, this
probably
is
probably not.
Yeah, because this is the tech billionaire thing, right? Also with Bezos and with the Google founders. So they're really into investing into this anti-aging or longevity biotechs, potentially with the hope of gaining something out of it. But super interesting area of research. And I mean, it sounds a little bit, if you have done this hype and if you add always this, let's say, not always positive image of the tech billionaire to it, it might reflect badly on the science. But in the end, I mean, this is important stuff that's being done. So it's good that someone is investing in it. The other story is versions of CRISPR-Cas that's done by Profluent. We talked about Profluent in a couple of episodes because I find them extremely cool. It's a company that designs, again, proteins that don't exist in nature. And what they did is to design new proteins of the CRISPR-Cas system, so these gene editors. And again, they found gene editors within their newly produced proteins that are, I would say, I think 400 amino acids different than the ones that exist in nature. So they are quite different, that have exactly the same efficiency in changing a gene than the original protein, but they don't do anything off target, which again, I mean, this is this is lab results. It does not mean it will do exactly the same in the patient, but again, very promising, very cool. New proteins can do better stuff. And the third one is from David Baker's lab that we just talked about, also one of the Nobel Prize winners of last year. And his lab designed proteins that can neutralize snake venom with an AI model. So they designed small proteins, I think just got published in Nature, where these proteins really bind to the harmful proteins from snake venom and can neutralize them.
Amazing stuff. What was going through my mind as you had those crazy examples was, when you do this step from going from in silico to in vivo, are there any hints that there might be a potential danger of really transferring those artificial proteins into the real world?
There is always, in general, a danger with genetically modified organisms. Protein per se do not replicate, so the protein itself should not do anything. There are some theories around prions, which are a little bit debated, I think, in the scientific community. So the prions which underlie Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease or mad cow disease are proteins that by themselves become replicating and then lead to the destruction of brain tissue. This is something that's very hard to propagate. So you would have to, I think, consume parts of the brain tissue from another species or the same species in order to get there. So I think this is not the most likely source of transmission. But that said, I mean, these proteins are produced by DNA sequences. So these could, of course, get out into the wild. Again, that said, I mean, if they are not in a viral vector, the chance of them spreading is relatively low. Often viral vectors are used for infecting cells. There are lab protocols to avoid them getting out. So I worked with these kinds of modified cells in the lab, and I think the safety risk for these kind of applications currently is not super high if you follow all the proper rules of the laboratory.
Now, data.
Data, yeah.
I mean, the gold standard has been so far collect as much as you can, and then you come to an application or something. Up to date, the general line as a private user or so makes fun using here and there ChatGPT. We all know that. It's, of course, based on huge amounts of data. And increasingly, in the science community, it's discussed. Do AI models need massive amounts of data? Maybe in the future, sometime, some will be able to go without the huge masses.
That is what Hassabis says, yes. From my point of view, and I am not a machine learning expert, I'm a biotech and pharma expert, but I would assume that the great success of DeepMind with AlphaFold and the awarding of the Nobel Prize has a lot to do not only with their brilliant model, but also with the readily available, highly curated, and very qualitative data that was stored in the protein database. And without this data, they could have not trained this model and made it so successful. And this protein database that stores protein structures that have been found experimentally by many different researchers and have been curated to a certain standard. This is quite unique. There are not so many, unfortunately, of these public repositories of very high qualitative data. And it turns out that it seems, at least at the current stage, that the biomedical data that is floating around publicly is not good enough maybe to train the AI models. Right. And this seems to be a severe limitation, because even though we have a lot of data, it's not put together in a good enough way. So we lack the metadata. So you don't know what the experimental conditions are, for example. You don't know when it was found. Also, with publicly available data, there is always this problem of reproduction. I think there are studies that between 30 and 50% of the data can be reproduced and the rest cannot be reproduced. Not, I think, because per se something went wrong, but just because the conditions were just very different. Right. So just throwing random data at a model can be actually quite confusing. And this is a little bit different when you look, for example, at genomes. There we have quite a lot of genomic data stored in biobanks. For example, one of the biggest data producers is the United Kingdom with their biobank. So they collect a lot of data from their inhabitants. There's also like a private public partnership in Iceland where there's a lot of genomes being sequenced. This is very helpful to have these types of data. But for other parts, and especially when we dive deeper into this question of biology, the data we would really need to make useful sense out of these biological mess, I would say. So we would need very fine-grained data. We would need to understand what happens at which time point. What happens if you're healthy, if you're diseased? What happens if you are a man or a woman? What happens to people who are old and young? What happens if you have eaten or not eaten? What happens if you have taken different drugs or not? And then multiply that by all the different genetic backgrounds of all people and all the different lifestyles of all the different people. And then you would get very useful information. But currently, we either have very standardized data that comes only, for example, from cells, or we have very incomplete and very badly annotated data where we just don't really know what's going on well enough. I remember when we had the episode on the polygenic risk scores that this question of data annotation was a big one.
Right, I remember.
It doesn't help us to know we have men and women in the data set if we don't know who the men and the women are.
Right. So a fantastic business case must be deep data mining, accurate finding of data that are reliable, right?
Yeah, but I
think, as I understand it.
Yes, true? That would be a good business case, but I think many of the biotechs have decided that this is not going to work and instead started to produce their own proprietary data. And this is common for many of the bigger players now, like Zara that I just talked about, Insitro, Recursion that just merged with Exscientia. So all of these biotechs, they are just producing their own highly qualitative data. This has also the other benefit that, of course, pharma is an industry that relies on intellectual property. So you do your own stuff, you can keep it to yourself. Exceptions to that. So originally, for example, AlphaFold 2 was made open source, the model, and they also released, I think, 200 million protein sequences of different species into a database. So this is a little bit of giving back, I would say, for using the publicly available data.
200 million sounds a lot.
Yeah, but
in biology currency, is it a lot or not that much?
No, it's a lot. It's a lot, yeah, but it's also many different species.
All right,
so it's
understood.
Not only humans, but different ones.
All right.
But the other thing is that, I mean, if you own the data, you might have a strategic advantage. That is very clear. And I think this is something that currently many of the biotechs are betting on, to have their own very well annotated data rather than investing in public data generation. There is also the idea of biotech sponsoring public data generation, for example. That's something that Regeneron is doing. They're trying to get patient genetic samples, and they're now, they have 10 million, but they're trying to add on top even more, again, collaborating in the United Kingdom, where you have better ways of sequencing genomes, and then trying to add on top also different data. Because in the end, having only genetics will only get you so far, and it's recognized very much, and this is another piece of evidence, that data becomes much more rich. So we are really now entering, and this from a biology point of view is very exciting, because it brings us closer to this higher hanging fruit to have multi-omics data. So omics being data that's produced in high throughput. So we don't only have genetics data, but we have RNA data, we have protein data, we have data of metabolomes, and all of that combined will give us a much better picture of what a human inside really might look like. And another really exciting trend is the creation of spatial data, because what we do usually as biologists is we chop everything to pieces and throw it together. And then we say like, yeah, somewhere there were like 50 different cell types, but we don't know which they were, because how would we know?
Sure.
And now we're moving into this area where we have spatial biology. So we will look at a cell, a single cell, and another single cell, and another single cell, and know what's going on inside these cells. And this is, of course, tremendously meaningful, because you can imagine that if you're looking to target a specific disease, that happens in one type of cell and not in the other, it would be actually very helpful to know what's going on in this cell and not in the other. And there is this really great initiative around VFRIGF that now end of 24 was published, the Human Cell Atlas, where they, I think, published now 62 million cells from around 10,000 donors. So having really now pretty comprehensive coverage of the relevant cells in the human body and having all these different layers of information from them. And this hopefully could again be, moving back to the more open source version of biology, this could be a great resource for academic researchers, but also for biotechs who want to use high quality open source information to understand human biology.
Altogether, we're very much, if you look at R&D, we're still at the R, extremely, and not that much at the D, but this is understandable. Are there any ideas around this future image of AIs capable of working with less data?
Yeah, I mean, there are ideas, and I find it very hard to judge them, I have to say. So.
Okay.
One of the ideas...
Because it would move AI more to the intelligence part, you know, not to the robotics sifting through data only, but making up their minds, if you will.
And I mean, something, it depends a little bit. So, I mean, one thing that you need on might be data, but another thing you might need to train a model, like, for example, a large language model could be labeled data, because somehow the model should know what it means. This is one of the, as far as I understand it, in the one day that I have read up on this topic, one of the claims of this DeepSeek R1 model, that a large part, so they did a multi-step training process with some labeled data, but the original model, apparently the DeepSeek R0 model, learned by reinforcement learning without any labels. So it just learned on data. They describe in the, and again, I mean, we take it with a grain of salt and we know all of this only since yesterday.
Right.
But they describe in their paper that the model had an aha moment.
So
the model, just by learning by itself, understood the rules of human language and got like, aha, now I'm smarter.
Wow.
So this, of course, if this reinforcement learning or self-supervised learning, this would potentially not need less data per se, but less effort in annotating the data. This could be one strategy.
Exactly.
Other strategies would be to have synthetic data, so have AI models generate data which trains the models. This, I think, has seen not that great results as far as I understand it, because I think the model gets with each iteration a little bit stupider if you really purely train it. And I think I saw that for text models, but also for image generation models. It works for a couple of iterations, and if you do it for too long, it gets complete gibberish. It loses, I think, this specificity. It gets completely generalized.
Absolutely.
And you can imagine that if you do that for biomedical data, if you, for example, want to extrapolate diversity in clinical trials and you have three individuals of a certain ethnicity, or you have like 100 men and 5 women, and then you extrapolate the features of those individuals by creating synthetic data, that could be quite tricky, because, I mean, whatever errors you have in that will be very generalized. I'm wondering if, like, on a very high level, this is something that we're going to see happening in real life with having GPT-4 or ChatGPT, other models, Gemini, etc. I mean, feeding, of course, also on the human-generated text, but also on the text of the internet that uses more and more of these models. So if the model and ourselves in vicious circle are going to make each other stupider with time. I mean, if you read through social media, this might be something that's already happening. And I think this is something very important in the biomedical space, that the models who excel at generalizing things, the large language models, they are often not that well suited for like getting very niche-y. So you need to tune a lot to get them to this very specific application, which they were not meant for. And this can be tricky. And I think this is something that we also, I mean, realize when we work with this application, that we need to be very strict with the model to allow it to feed only on certain data sources and to have very specific rules of prompting to tell it not to make up stuff, let's say, that again becomes too general. This is a little bit tricky, and I think this, at least for these large language models, the transformer-based models that we're currently talking about, I'm not sure how much we can reduce the data without resorting to synthetic data. That said, I also, so when I prepared for this episode, I hadn't really, like, I didn't know anything about DeepSeek. So maybe it's also a question, because they applied some interesting methods for training the model, which were then, I mean, they had at some point some human intervention that was very simple and was based on coherency and fluency. So trying to make the model make sense. And it really excels also apparently at reasoning and math. So I'm wondering if this kind of strategy to really tune the model, not so much on what data it uses, but more on which types of responses you want to get out. But that, then again, I mean, this is for me too new topic to really make any claims
sometime in the future.
About. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And other than that, I think having better data will mean having better outcomes of the models. And what Isomorphic Labs, the company of Hassabis, is doing, I mean, they're designing chemical molecules. And what they're trying to do is to reduce the numbers of cycles that the molecule has to go through in order to be ready for the clinic. I think this is something that is a narrower application where maybe this no data or it's not about data mindset can work very well. I think if it's really about understanding the complexity of a human tissue, I don't really see the case of not feeding in data.
At the end of the day, will we face the return of the Jedi, meaning not the Jedi from Star Wars, but the human excellence, the human brains coming into play when it comes to drug development and the better outcome in medicine? Because we at a certain point will face, okay, models are helpful and good, but we need the bright minds even more.
I don't think this will ever change. I mean, we also need the bright minds to design the models, and we also need, let's say, leadership personalities who drive this innovation and who are convinced and go through with it. Because, I mean, some of them, and I think this is the exciting part about targeting this higher hanging fruit, the payoffs might be a bit later coming. And maybe some of them won't pay off, but I think it's still important. And I think this is something that's generally very important in science, is to do the long shot and not do only the stuff that will give you quick results, because this is not the way that biomedical science works, because it's very complex. And that doesn't mean that process cannot be sped up significantly. We saw that for the COVID vaccines. That's
amazing. RNA.
There's a lot of possibility. But before that, there were researchers working on the topic for decades, quietly in their laboratories. And if they hadn't done that, this would not have been possible.
Absolutely.
So having both of that, and I think this acknowledgement of biotech, that the higher hanging fruit, the biology targeting, the complex molecules, the complex, rich, highly spatial data will be relevant, and to really move towards this understanding of what a human is made of and how disease works. I think this, again, has massive potential, and AI will play a role in that, but AI will not decide that, right? AI will never say, like, well, who knows, if it has an aha moment, maybe it will say something and we'll all be baffled by it.
Possible.
Possible. Absolutely. But still, I mean, the researchers need to set the AI to get to the aha moment. Sure. So in the end, we need the brilliance of humans. And I think AI is only a helpful tool. And in the end, maybe Yankopoulos is partly right about it's only about pattern recognition. But Yeah, but it's not, it's such a, he says, or, I mean, I didn't,
it's
I don't
hear. It's not a small thing.
No, I don't hear him saying it. I read him saying it, but it sounds a little bit derogative, but it's not,
it's not at all.
Extremely cool to recognize patterns. And we saw that for, again, we get back to this example of AlphaGo, of this move that has never made by a human player that had, I think, a 1 in 10,000 chance of being made that the AI decided to make. So it doesn't mean that recognizing patterns and learning from these patterns is a stupid thing. Absolutely. It's actually a very meaningful thing.
Yeah.
If I may say one last part that I find quite interesting, and that I have been last year when we were thinking and talking a lot about large language models, thought about a lot, the lack of world knowledge of these models. And again, this goes back to only seeing patterns. This is not, I don't think, solvable in the way that these models are at the current stage. And having a return to models that also have world knowledge, and who knows, maybe combining them in a chain of different models for creating more reasonable AI science frameworks, where you have on the one hand the pattern recognition capabilities of the large language model, but you also have models that have world knowledge. Because what you don't get out of the large language model is causality. It's inherently stochastic. And I think even without like being anywhere near to being a data scientist or machine learning person, or I mean, you just need to work with ChatGPT and ask the same question 3 times and you will know that causality is a very different or very difficult feat for these models. That said, biology also has both. I think there is a lot of causality. If you do this, then this happens. But there's also a lot of stochasticity in the biological processes. Everything is buffered, and you kind of know what will happen if you give a drug, but for some people, also something completely different will happen, which again has to do with their genome, with their lifestyle, with maybe some other infections that they have, maybe with other drugs that they're taking, maybe if they have eaten lunch or not, and anything in between. And I think both the causality and the stochasticity are important parts of human biology, and I think tackling them with different types of models will get maximum benefit.
One sentence each, please. Do you expect another big bang or a quantum leap in the next like 3-4 years in AI, in biology, in drug development?
Yes, but I don't know what it will be.
Of course not. How could you? And the last thing, I mean, we're in Europe and there's a regulatory framework, and in many, many, we've been talking about this many times, and in many concerns, it's a good thing that we have a bureaucracy like we do. For the competition, it's not that good. So also on this side, one final sentence, what chances do we have?
That is an easy question to answer in one sentence. I think Europe has no chance of regulating problems away. We have the situation of the big tech companies that are mainly in the US and partly in China that follow their own rules, both of them in a different way. They offer useful tools. These tools are, from a data privacy perspective and from a transparency perspective, dangerous to use. We probably will have to continue to use them and make the best of it. And I think be open about the risks that are entailed, which kind of data you want to feed in. I mean, DeepSeek is open source, so you can use it. But there, I think, is also in the usage notes that they will use your input to train the model, which, I mean, why shouldn't they? Mm-hmm. So
we'll see. Wow, what a journey. Thank you very much, Izzy.
Thank you.
This was another episode of the BioRevolution podcast. Now, from now on, without, we're doomed, we're saved. We explained this at the beginning of the episode. Which ideas do we have going forward? What will be the next one?
So we'll talk in the next episode. I would really like to talk about this idea that we've been discussing privately quite a bit, what it actually means to have this more restrictive climate and a little bit anti-science climate. So extrapolating this a little bit, what it actually would mean to have more anti-science movement for, let's say, on the long run, human health and drug development. And then I think we're going to talk about something that I find very exciting, hopefully with a guest, which is the dark genome. So the parts of the genome that are not yet explored, uncharted territory, topic that I've been wanting to talk about for a very long time.
Sounds like a novel stuff to write.
Absolutely.
We'll do that.
Yes.
Once we're not into doing podcasts anymore, we write a dark genome or something would be nice. Again, thank you, Izzy. Thank you for listening to the BioRevolution podcast. We're happy if you subscribe to our show. And if you have ideas for what we should cover, please drop a line at
sciencetales.com.
Sciencetales.com. Thank you again.